If you regularly use social media and apps, you are sharing more private information than ever. It is now common to sign up for services via Facebook, which means you're sharing everything that you share on Facebook with companies. Facebook is also using face recognition software, and the New York Times recently reported that Uber is tracking the location of customers' devices even when they're not actively using the app. So how can we use the digital services and the tools we value without the data mining we distrust? Do you have control over your personal information? How can we combat these new tactics? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A key part of President Obama's effort to give citizens more control over how companies collect and share personal information just hit a wall, according to the New York Times. Nine civil liberties and consumer advocacy groups, including the ACLU and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, walked out of talks with industry groups discussing how to write guidelines for the fair commercial use of face recognition technology. At issue is Facebook's expansion of its faceprint technology. The company has amassed one of the largest databases of faceprints, just like a fingerprint. They're a set of identifying markers that are distinct to you. Privacy advocates said they walked out because they could not achieve minimum rights for consumers, such as obtaining permission before employing face recognition to identify individual people on the street, for example. In a statement, the group said, at a base minimum, people should be able to walk down a public street without fear that companies they've never heard of are tracking their every movement and identifying them by name using facial recognition technology. So there's this issue on the privacy front. And then another one, the New York Times reports that Uber is tracking the location of customers' devices even when they're not actively using Uber's app. So now that so many of us share even more information with companies than we did just a few years ago, where do we stand on these issues? Well, a recent University of Pennsylvania study found that many of us feel we have no control over how companies use our information. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about new tactics in data mining and how we can combat them. Today, we're joined by Frank Pasquale, professor of law at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law. He's a fellow at Yale Law School's Information and Society Project and author of the book, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. Thank you for joining us. And Julia Horowitz is Consumer Protection Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. That's a nonprofit that works to protect privacy and promote the public voice in decisions concerning the future of the Internet. Hi, Julia. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. And hi, Frank.
Hey, Julia.
So let's start off by talking about where we are at today, because we have done so many shows on online privacy, but it's really interesting when you look at how so many of us now interact with apps, how when you sign up for services, it's easier to sign up through Facebook than to use your email and put in a password that you then have to remember. And then there's this face recognition software. So there's a lot of new things happening right now. And Frank, when you look at the new concerns, what's really at the top of your list?
Well, I think what we're seeing building now is companies moving towards having a universal database of really disparate information ranging from people's financial position to their what they're buying online, to what they're reading, to their movements, to the way their face looks, et cetera. And what I'm really concerned about is that a lot of the firms involved try to say, oh, we just care about one very narrow market segment, et cetera. But to the extent they're all using these sort of universal verification, identity validation schemes like the ones put forward by Facebook and Google, et cetera, we really are creating this type of universal dossier. And one, a law professor, Paul Ohm, calls this the database of ruin, because once you have that much information about people, you have incredible power and ability to manipulate them and to really respond to them in ways and that they can never really understand.
How does this differ from what we talked about and learned about, say, 5 years ago?
I'd say that the big difference that's happening nowadays is that we're getting more and more data integration. So whenever you hear someone say big data, I know that's a bit of a buzzword, people try to pass off big data as a new way of serving customers and a new way of understanding reality, et cetera. But we should also understand that big data is a way of understanding people's weaknesses, their fears, things that are bad about them, et cetera. You saw that, for example, with the recent Office of Personnel Management hack, where because the government investigates everyone so deeply to get security clearances and all, they have to sort of confess. It's almost like a governmental confessional where they confess the things that might be embarrassing or discrediting about them. Well, they trusted the government to keep that data secret and secure, but it didn't. And the problem is that, you know, when you think about even the government itself losing this stuff, it's all the easier for a lot of these other firms to eventually be hacked and for disastrous reuses to be made of all this information.
And Julia, what are your thoughts on this? You're Consumer Protection Counsel with EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and EPIC has been doing work for a couple of decades. I mean, when the internet exploded in the late 90s, EPIC was really at the forefront of raising concerns about privacy before most of us were even really thinking about it. I'm talking specifically about online privacy. So what concerns you the most about the changes that we're seeing?
I think the thing that concerns me the most is the lack of coherent response from Congress. So over the last several years, we've seen data breach bills introduced and universal data privacy bills introduced, and they don't seem to be going very far, which is surprising to me as well as concerning, because privacy is such a bipartisan issue, and it's of concern to so many people, as we've seen from this University of Pennsylvania study recently, that you'd think that this would be an easy thing for Congress to get behind, but we haven't really seen any kind of unified response, and that's my chief concern, I think.
And why is that? What explains that?
Well, I think it probably largely has to do with this thing that Frank alluded to, which is that to a degree, the companies that rely the most on data collection are also in control of the dialogue, the public discourse over data collection. So we hear big data, and we generally think this is something to a tactic that companies use to better serve consumers. But that's sort of a definition that was set by the companies themselves, and probably not the most accurate reflection of the way that people are using it to talk to each other. So the more power the company has, the more that they can control the public discussion about these new technologies.
And Frank, what are your thoughts about how citizens see this issue? As I mentioned, this recent University of Pennsylvania study found that many of us feel we just don't have control over how companies use our information, even though the overwhelming majority of respondents said it's not fair for companies to collect information about them without their knowledge.
Yes, I think that was a very important study, and I think that the future of privacy regulation is going to hinge on complementing, say, notice and consent practices where people are informed and have the opportunity to opt out of different data collection practices. We've got to complement that with the idea that certain types of data should never be used in certain contexts. So to give a really concrete example, employers shouldn't be able to go into these shadow health profiles that are emerging now and try to judge people on the basis of whether they are likely to be diabetic or not or something like that. There are laws against that now, but it's really hard to determine when the law has been violated, because a lot of employers invoke their own version of privacy and say, oh, the way we make decisions is a trade secret. So this conflict, and this is the deeper side of the privacy story, is that as all of us as consumers and workers, as our privacy is increasingly invaded, the corporations that invade that privacy are using trade secrecy law, so we are totally in the dark about what they're doing with the data and how they're dealing with us based on that data.
Well, and so what can we conclude? Because at a time when we feel like we don't have control over how the companies use our information, we often hear, for example, there was a piece at the Huffington Post, Hank Samfer writes, "This mining is akin to stalking and a complete lack of privacy. They find everything about me online. They follow my move. They have access to my photos, my videos. They know my friends. They know the places I visit, where I buy things." And so, and this is true. I mean, a lot of people share very personal information on Facebook. You RSVP to events. You post photos talking about where you were yesterday, where you ate dinner. Can you just talk about what we can conclude that the companies know about us and what they do with that information, even if they're not explicit about it?
Well, I think one of the things that we should all be wary of is something that Christian Sandvik has called corrupt personalization. So we're used to thinking about, you know, the ads we get online as personalized to us. You know, like if I'm interested in travel, I'm going to see a lot of travel ads. If I'm interested in cooking, I'm going to see a lot of cooking ads, et cetera. I think what we have to be aware of, first of all, is that even in the mere marketing context, sometimes we're being offered things on the basis of knowledge of the company has knowledge of us that is disturbing us. So, for example, it's been exposed that companies will charge more to people who live further away from the brick-and-mortar stores. How they find out about that? Well, they found out because they are tracking exactly the location of your computer when you're web browsing or things like that. There is some interesting movement, by the way, in California, I think, about restricting certain forms of price discrimination that are done in that sort of gouging way. The next step would be to look at what the data brokers are selling about us in the financial and credit context. Also to look at the scores that are out there. There's a report called The Scoring of America that talks about literally thousands of scores that are out there. Some of them are things like how likely is a person to be a fraud? How likely is a person to be a criminal at their place of work? How likely are they to succeed at their place of work? How sick are they? Do they adhere to their medication? All of these things are out there, and they're uses of the data that are now really opaque, and people don't even have a chance to know about them, much less correct them.
What would you add to that list, Julia?
What was the title of the list?
Frank was just talking about how these companies can use our information and make assumptions without us even knowing about it, just based on everyday things that we do online.
I think that lots of the things that Frank was just talking about are a reflection of this this set of principles that we've had in the United States for almost 40 or 50 years called the Fair Information Practices, which sort of dictate or outline the kinds of access and controls that people should have about data that's collected about them. And while they are not codified into a law, or at least not into a federal law, they touch on a lot of the things that Frank was just talking about. For example, they suggest that consumers should have the right to know what kinds of data are being collected about them. They should have access to that data. They should be able to correct any mistakes, and they should be able to be confident that that data is being kept safe and free from hacking, for example. So I think that the fair information practices is something that I might look to next.
And what is the status of that?
The current administration proposed a Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights early in 2012 that had in it a codification of many of the fair information practices. And it was a pretty good proposal. But then it sort of fell off the collective radar screen for a number of years and didn't reemerge until earlier this year when the White House put forth a what they called a discussion draft of another Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, but it was a much weaker one. So it contained some of those same fair information practices, but also had some real downsides. For example, it proposed a set of fair information practices that would represent sort of a ceiling on the different ways that states could legislate rather than a floor that would allow states to legislate for more privacy protections if they so chose.
Julia Horowitz is Consumer Protection Counsel for EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a nonprofit that works to protect privacy. Frank Pasquale is Professor of Law at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law. He's a fellow at Yale Law School's Information and Society Project and author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about new tactics in data mining and how we can combat them. So many of us use apps without even thinking about it because we want to take advantage of these services. But what happens when you put in all that information in your app and you allow a company to track you? The New York Times recently reported that Uber is tracking the location of customers' devices when they're not actively using Uber's app. There's also a lot of concerns over Facebook's facial recognition technology. In many cases, you actually have to opt out. So by default, you are opted in. On your phone, for example, location services are turned on almost every app you download. You have to actually go in and turn it off. By default, it's on. So let's just share information here. What have you learned about how companies are using your information? If you've used any tactics to combat this data mining, share your tips with us. If you have any questions, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I was taking photos on my mom's phone the other day, and all of the photos were tagged where we were. It doesn't do that on my phone because I have my location off. So if you take photos, the place where you are is automatically tagged. You might like that, you might not, but you have to go in and turn that off. So give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi there, Rose. Thank you. What I wanted to pick up on your comment on the opting out, and I wanted the guest to address how many companies employ that versus, because I'm really in favor of opt in as opposed to opt out, because the default setting is in the favor of privacy. And if you don't mind giving up information, then you can take the extra step to opt in as opposed to opt out, because most people, I think the companies know this, take the path of least resistance and don't do anything.
Right.
So that if you're saying if you want to opt out, you have to actually do something, I think they know fewer people are going to do that.
That's right. And so few of us read the privacy policies, and in many cases, the text is so small, it's hard to read them anyway. Frank, do you want to talk about that opt-in and opt-out clauses?
That is a great topic to bring up. And I think that there are a few issues that really are sensitive there. But before I get to that, I just wanted to say that your example of the photo location had a somewhat entertaining, newsworthy angle on it as well a few months ago, because that was the Representative Aaron Schock of Congress. Actually, it was the metadata on his photos that led to journalists going after him and eventually forcing his resignation because it showed exactly where he was at various points. And it seemed as though it had to have been funded by non-disclosed sources. So it is amazing. Like, we've already seen people, and we've also seen actually pictures of celebrities were matched up to a taxi database in New York that sort of showed exactly where they were going. If you found a picture at exactly the right time, you know, you could sort of match it up to this database. So a lot of people don't realize, like, the things that seem really innocuous at the outset can be used against them in various ways. To get to opt-in and opt-out, I agree that a lot more stuff ought to be opt-in. You know, I think, for example, this face recognition technology really ought to be opt-in, because the uses of it, particularly when you think about a world full of micro drones, of very miniaturized, totally mobile methods of not only tracking but also sort of either controlling individuals, that's just on the horizon. And that could be perfectly deployed with this face recognition technology. It also could, you could keep track of everybody at a protest instantaneously. That people already are doing that in some ways, but this would just accelerate that process. And there's a long history of government buying access to these private databases. So when you hear people say, oh, it's just a private database, what can Facebook do to me? Well, we have so much evidence out there from Snowden, from other people, that there's a big commerce between government and the big tech companies. But my only caveat there would be about opt-in versus opt-out is that sometimes you do wonder that there might be populations that could be left out of the types of data processing that could help them. So, for example, in, say, health contexts, sometimes it does make sense to, you know, study a population and say, oh, wow, we found there was a cancer cluster in this street. And you might never find that cancer cluster if people have to opt into that type of a study.
Hmm. So at this point, it really is up to us to figure out if we've been opted in or if we have to go physically opt out, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so anytime you download an app, the chances are, though, your location services are automatically turned on. And Frank, you brought up a bunch of points there. And let's take the photo first, because I think this is really important. A lot of people do not realize this. But if you take a photo on your phone and you put it on Facebook or Flickr or PhotoBucket or any of these services, and your location service is on, in many cases, people could actually find, if you're at home, for example, people could find your home embedded in data with those photos, right? I mean, these images contain a lot of information and traces left by digital cameras or photo manipulation software. This was getting a lot of attention last year, especially for parents who like to post photos of their kids on social media.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that there's, especially when you think about the potential retargeting or reapplication of massive databases of where streets are or locations are, et cetera, it's very easy to imagine that type of re-identification. It's something that's actually coming up now, too, in the hospital healthcare context, because there's something called Figure One, which is the Instagram for physicians. And this is a service where physicians will take pictures of very unusual cases and put them online and then share it with other doctors. It can be a very good service, but all too often, they're not really thinking about ways in which the information could be re-identified to the patients that are having their pictures taken. So this is, and yeah, there's just so much data that's put into these photos. And also, you know, when you think about the ways in which there are fingerprints of your devices, so if you can go online and see how unique your cell phone is, you know, if it's one of like only one in 300,000 are like yours, again, that's something that's really identifiable in a way. So, yeah, it's important for people to realize that just so much information is embedded in all these traces that we leave behind.
And CNN has a piece about this. They report that Apple and Google systems ask users about one or two times for permission to access their location in order to provide additional services. If you click OK on that pop-up, every photo you take is tagged with GPS coordinates. And you know that GPS is so specific now. I mean, you, right where you are, GPS can find you. So if you want to disable that, you have to go into your phone and turn the location service off. This one's really, really important because you're just taking photos of family and the location is tagged onto that photo. Do you want to add anything about photo privacy, Julia, and what we need to know about?
I'm not sure. I think you covered a lot of territory. I guess I'd just like to add that one of the things that we've seen a lot recently is this phenomenon of device fingerprinting, which is the ability of either companies or individuals, if they're skilled enough, to take a look at data about your device, your phone or your computer, and to sort of make an individualized determination about who you are. So things like the operating system that you're running and the version of it, an internal clock measurement called the clock lag. If you sort of tally up all of these characteristics of the feature that device that you're using, then it might turn out that actually your device is completely unique. So to the extent that any of that data is left over in the pictures that you post or something like that, it might be possible to determine not only, you know, where you are, but which device you're using.
Julia Horowitz is Consumer Protection Counsel for EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Frank Pasquale is a fellow at Yale Law School's Information and Society Project and author of The Black Box Society. Today we are talking about privacy. There are so many new tactics now in data mining, from photos to apps to face recognition software. We'll talk more about that after the break. It's very common now. If you post a photo on Facebook, it'll ask you to tag your friends, and it is so good. it gets your friends, at least it gets my friends right, almost 99.9% of the time, which is a little strange. And so recently there was a meeting in Washington and privacy advocates walked out of talks with industry groups talking about how to write guidelines for the fair use of face recognition technology for customers. And so we will talk about that after the break. And we'd love to hear from you. What concerns do you have? And if you have any tools in your toolbox for us to use to combat this, we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll find all the links related to today's show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll have a conversation with journalist Sandy Tolan about his new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. He tells the story of Ramzi Aberdwan and his journey from stone thrower during the First Intifada to music teacher, transforming the lives of thousands of Palestinian children living under occupation in the West Bank. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about online privacy, offline privacy also when you're talking about using your phone, and new tactics in data mining and how we can combat them. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've got concerns about privacy, or how do you feel about this recent University of Pennsylvania study? It found that many of us feel we just don't have control over how companies use our information. What are your thoughts on that? And if you have any tools or some secrets you want to share about using information, whether it's opting out, turning off the location service on your phone, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Frank Pasquale, professor of law at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law and author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Julia Horowitz is a consumer protection counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And let's go next to Pat in Monterey. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks. Good, thanks
for having me on and for answering a lot of questions about all the geotagged metadata that is install a lot of files and photos we share.
Thank you.
So my question is this. We talked a lot about kind of the interfaces, but how much money is generated by these algorithms for things like targeted advertisements and all these other things we opt into?
That's a great question. Frank, is there data on that?
You know, there is an estimate by, I believe, the Industry Council that was big data, or this type of data is driving a $156 billion economy.
Wow.
You do always have to take that with a grain of salt, though, because sometimes the big data firms will claim credit for, you know, the whole value of transactions when really the ability of big data to target people is just a small fraction of that. I do think, though, that, you know, in the future, what we've also got to be thinking about is how do we really measure the costs, too. Costs of inconvenience, of vulnerability, of hacking, all the time having to, people have to spend to, you know, put their credit back together when they've been hacked or when there's some sort of identity theft. There's a lot of cost to this big data economy, too, that really we aren't accounting for.
Well, and also, I mean, these companies are making profits based on citizens either using their services or sharing content, right? Like, for example, Facebook. We all add content to Facebook on a regular basis. So how would you even come up with a number?
Well, you know, there are there's an institute called the Ponemon Institute, and there's some other privacy players who have estimated the cost of health data breaches, at least. And then there are other people on the other side, you know, in the healthcare context that are trying to get a sense of, you know, what can be the results in the savings from more deployment of data technology in healthcare. So I wouldn't give up on it, but I do think it's something that's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of study.
Okay, well, thank you for the call. We have an email from Marianne who says, people may think I'm off base, but I contend that no amount of turning off location services, Wi-Fi, and any other tracking service works the way you'd think. In other words, the device can still be tracked and is. Not sure if anything about this has come out in the Snowden documents or will in the future. Frank, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I'm sympathetic with arguments about the potential ineffectiveness of privacy-enhancing technologies. So I'll give two examples of those. One, going directly to the emailer's point, would be that, you know, just for the phone to operate, you know, it's got to have some sense of, you know, where you are. I would think, I mean, admittedly, the location tracking, I mean, I'm not, you know, Mr. Technical expert on exactly the code that goes on with location tracking versus the cellular signal reaching you, but I just have a sense, you know, that there's always going to be some sort of slippage when you've got the thing on, simply because when you look at people that are really professionals who try to avoid being tracked, I mean, they aren't carrying around the operating cell phone with them very often. You know, they realize the sort of they have the sort of suspicions that the caller has. The second point I would make is that there are some examples of using the privacy-enhancing technology that becomes a red flag for people. So in the wake of the Snowden revelations, there were some documents at least that said that the people who used Tor would potentially be targeted, or that this was sort of a red flag in some way. We see also after there was a bomb threat at Harvard a few years ago, and the way that the police found the bomber, like sort of narrowed it down, was to sort of look at, or the threatener, was that they looked at who was using certain privacy-enhancing technologies. So, you know, I think we have to be really careful and not think that just by getting better technologies of encryption, we can solve this problem. What we really have to start thinking about is, as a society, how are we socially, politically, legally going to come to a consensus about what uses of data and collection of data is all right and what should be forbidden?
Well, that's another great question for listeners. What is all right and what should be forbidden when it comes to what companies, what information they keep about you, what they track? 866-798-8255. And since Martha brought up, Marianne, since she brought up cell phones, I did want to announce that next Tuesday we're going to do a show about cell phones and wireless technologies. Should safety guidelines be strengthened? Should there be a sticker on your phone talking about radiation? That was just passed in Berkeley. And there's a really good event at the Commonwealth Club on Monday about this. It's free at 11:30, and you can find it at the Commonwealth Club's website. We're going to do this show on Tuesday because this is somewhat related. So thank you for that email. And let's. Martha has an email regarding data mining. She says, everyone does it, including progressive organizations and employment sites. If I sign a petition, I get bombarded with emails on a daily basis. I don't need 20 emails on the TPP every day, and the possibility for having my private information compromised grows. It's viral marketing, and everything is for sale. It's just alienating. It makes me want to throw out my computer. Well, that's another one that people are concerned about, Julia, is when you sign up for things, you're bombarded, and you have no idea who sold your information to what company or what organization.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that gets back to a couple of the points that we've made today concerning the lack of transparency about who's collecting your data, which companies have access to the things that you sign up for, and also your ability to access information about yourself. You may have profiles that are traded between any number of different companies who are all using them for different purposes, and none of that is something that you knew when you provided the information in the first place. And I think this also touches on our conversation about opting in and opting out, where some of the opt-in, opt-out are features on cell phones, and some things are opting into having your data traded and opting out of that, and those can be less intuitive and less easy to find.
All right. Well, thank you for the email. Serena says a great book to read is The Circle by Dave Eggers. The basic concept becomes that people are taught that wanting to have privacy and not be online constantly via social media becomes a selfish thing. And we actually have sort of a related call on this. Let's go to Anonymous in Oakland. Hi, welcome to the show.
I just want to say I've wanted a simple life, and so I don't have a smartphone. I don't have internet at home. I do have an email, and I am being bombarded by the petitions I click on. And I'm considering this after listening to this program to delete everything and not have an email. So there is a stigma involved in this culture about not having all this machinery. I walk down the street, I see all this craziness, people peering into these little machines, you know, trailing, having their dog trail behind. They don't even know the animal is there. It's insane. It's getting frenetic. It's insane. I think we need to reevaluate. A lot of people are getting electrically sensitive to wireless and all of this stuff, but we're ignoring it. Thank you.
Well, we're going to talk about that on Tuesday. And to your point, someone was just saying that at the Warriors game, some of the people who had front row seats were texting and on their phones, and in some cases they got hit by basketballs and because they weren't paying attention to the game. But what about that point, Frank, that some people don't really want to use all this technology, but in some cases, I mean, in addition to the stigma, in some cases you can't even apply for jobs unless you're using technology.
Yes, I think that opting out can be a solution for some folks, but I think that we've got to realize that in many contexts it's not a solution because, you know, I know that as a professional, you know, I need to be on certain social networks watching what other people are saying, you know, to learn from them, hoping that people are paying attention to what I'm saying, et cetera. And I think there's a classic example, actually. This programmer, Kathy Sierra, was really, her career was taking off. She's doing really well. In part because of her internet presence, and then she was driven off by a bunch of people harassing her. And I think that, you know, the problem is that, and also we've got to realize that, like, a lot of these online ecologies are particularly hostile to women, to minorities, and we've got to sort of make, I think, as part of a pro-privacy stance, a stance of overall online ecologies and online life being an equal opportunity platform. So that, you know, people don't have to worry about, so it's not just the rich and the well-protected and people with insurance that can go online. It's anybody that can go online and know that that online activity is not going to lead to some horrific outcome for them.
Right, and we've done so many shows about online harassment and so many women getting rid of social media because it's become so horrific for them. Death threats, rape threats, you know, putting addresses online. A lot of pressure has been put on specifically Twitter and Facebook to take real action on this. People have said that they have not done enough to really step up to the plate. When it comes to privacy, Frank, why don't you take this one first? What can citizens do to put pressure on these companies, and have you seen any changes as a result of pressure?
I think that the most important thing citizens can do is to elect people who are going to appoint regulators that are not afraid of the companies. And I know that usually people say, well, sign this petition or try to opt out, et cetera. But frankly, you know, one or two people leaving Google or Facebook means nothing to them. Getting an angry letter means nothing to them. You know, there's so little, even if you're a business, I could tell people don't advertise on them. But on the other hand, like, that may leave people lacking a critical source of information and access to future customers and future employees, et cetera. So I really think that, you know, we've got to look to the only thing that is big enough to stand up to several of these companies is the state. And also, I would say, you know, donate to Epic, donate to other groups that are trying to care, because I think a lot of times it's these groups that are watching all the time that develop expertise that are able to understand what's going on. So often it's hard for us, even to just the busyness of people's daily lives, even to understand what's going on. So to have expert activists, advocates out there is just critical, I think.
And what would you add to that, Julia, in terms of the power of citizens? And have you seen any specific changes because of pressure?
I think I'd have to agree with Frank. I think vote privacy. I think that too often people forget when they get into the polling booths that privacy is pretty much a part of political platforms now, and that it doesn't take too much digging to figure out what your either state or local or national representative stances are with respect to data privacy and consumer protection. So, you know, do a little citizen homework and find out who best represents your interests. And if you choose, donate to Epic.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. Let's go back to calls. Let's hear from Dorothy in San Francisco. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm another one like Anonymous. I don't have any social media. I don't have internet at home. I do have email, and my question, I'm interested in possible alternatives. I'm trying to extricate myself from Google. I use DuckDuckGo as a search tool because they don't track your queries. And I'm wondering if your guests know of email services that do not keep your information or track you or aim advertising at you.
All right. Thank you so much. And I'm glad you brought up DuckDuckGo. A lot of people bring that up when we do these shows. Julia, do you have any advice for no tracking email services?
Sure. I would look into Silent Circle software. It's a privacy and encryption-focused information company. And also, I believe that Frank earlier brought up the Tor network. So using Tor is always a popular way to stay as anonymous as possible on the internet.
I've never heard of Silent Circle. Is this user-friendly?
Yes, I think it's increasingly user-friendly as it gains popularity.
Okay. So Silent Circle, and we'll put links on our website. What about you, Frank? Do you have any suggestions?
You know, I have to admit, I am more of a legal analyst than I am sort of someone trying to keep on top of which technology to use. And part of that is because my stance in my book is that it is very difficult for the average user or even experts to keep track of whether the service that they're using has been compromised. So I feel like I also have a deeper sort of philosophical view that sometimes I feel that to some extent I am subjecting myself to what everybody else is. I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a way in which sometimes the privacy-enhancing technology discourse can lead people to, I think it could lead to an elite of people that could be leading society as a whole toward better privacy laws to sort of try to escape into the technology that protects them, but maybe not necessarily protects the others who are not using it.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not saying I criticize them for doing this, or you know, but I just sort of, I myself, just a combination of a reticence to try to figure out exactly what's going on all the time, and also because of this kind of egalitarianism of like, well, most people are in this and I'm just going to be in it with them. Those two things together for me make me less of a follower or an expert in those areas.
I hear exactly what you're saying, because sometimes it takes extra time to go to sign up for these services, to figure out how they work. And by default, you just tend to go to the search engine that your browser uses instead of typing in DuckDuckGo. But it seems like there would be a massive market here for a company that was honest about wanting to protect privacy. And I haven't really heard that from the major companies. Have you, Frank?
No, I actually don't think there will be a massive market. And I mean, I hate to, you know, be... I mean, I know there are a lot of startups in here that really care about it. And, you know, I do talk with them. I love to, you know, help them in any way that I can. But on the other hand, I also want to inject a note of realism, which is that for most people, it's just very difficult to really spend a lot of time thinking through these issues and to sort of anticipate years hence that, you know, a few inopportune searches on, you know, for whatever might be proscribed or stigmatic or stigmatized, you know, years from now are going to come back and haunt them. You know, so I just sort of feel like it's hard for me to see, given how quickly consumer decisions are made. Like if you study, you know, when I study consumer decision making and marketing publications, so often people's decision just comes down to price, you know, price and how quickly it comes through. That's been the key to Google's success, is they are the quickest by far. And when you have that is sort of the overwhelming tide of inertia in consumer preferences, it's hard for me to sort of, and also I would say too, you know, I hate putting the burden on the consumer to try to figure all this stuff out.
Right.
You know, I can just barely, like I've heard people tell me, like when I would write about Uber, I just think it's going to end up being a monopoly. And people say, oh, it's so easy to download the app for Lyft or for these alternatives to Uber. And I say, you know, when I'm looking for a car or when someone's looking, they're going to just go to the thing that is always reliable, and they're not going to really spend 5 minutes thinking, oh, I should compare the price of Lyft and Uber and Sidecar and all the rest. It's just an unrealistic thing to expect of people, given how harried people's work lives are and the rest.
And I have to throw in Flywheel. That's the taxi app, which is always left out.
Yes.
when we're talking about these, I don't call them sharing, but these car services.
Yes. Yes.
To that point, the New York Times reports that Uber is tracking the location of customers' devices when they're not actively using Uber's app. How does that work?
You know, I saw this story about Uber where they were looking at all the cars at once as God view. And I think this is really a great metaphor for the type of intimate information that these companies want. They don't just want to sell you a car service. What they essentially want to do is to have such a complete profile of you that it becomes almost impossible for you to pull away because they've got so much data about where you might be. And then, you know, if they can track, they might track, they eventually want to, say, predict what the demand will be over time. So if they know that you go to the theater, say, at 7 o'clock or to a movie, then they might be able to add more cars to that area at 10 o'clock because they can anticipate that there's going to be demand for the Ubers at 10 o'clock or
uh-huh.
something. You know, so it's that. And that also gets, this God's view thing is so important because it gets into the idea that these companies aren't just after doing one-to-one services of you. They want to be able to predict the future and to some extent control that future. Hmm. And that's what all this data collection is ultimately about.
What are your thoughts on this, Julia, that a company like Uber is tracking people even when they're not using the service?
The thing that I think is interesting about Uber's recent privacy policy rollout is the way that they've been framing it as giving users more control, which is so surprising to me because the very next sentence is by tracking where users are going at all times. So this is, again, touching back to the opt-in, opt-out. Apparently under this new policy, users will have some opt-in choices, but it's not clear what those choices will be or how effective they'll be. And it also seems that under this new policy, Uber might have access to your contact list mm-hmm. in a way that it didn't before. So, you know, there's a real possibility that not only will your movements be tracked, but whoever it is that you keep in your contact list, whether it's employers or doctors or family and friends, will be the subject of advertising or even something like requests for ride shares with Uber.
Hmm. And so, I mean, at a time when so many people are using apps to order food, to get dry cleaning, I mean, you name it, you can pretty much do anything now with apps. What concerns you about the use of apps, Frank, and how much information people are sharing?
I think that the app landscape is troubling because there are especially new fitness apps, health apps, et cetera, that are out there, and that this is very sensitive information, and that way too many people falsely assume or wrongly assume that health information is covered by HIPAA. HIPAA doesn't cover health information. It covers providers. It covers doctors and hospitals. But if you, say, put all your medical information on an app that is just, you know, you download to your phone, that's known as a personal health record. Mm. There's some regulation of it under the Federal Trade Commission, but very light regulation. And, you know, people are not going to know what hits them when they find out that they're essentially enabling these shadow health profiles of themselves to be created, and ultimately they may well be transferred, sold, made public generally.
You just reminded me, the medical clinic I go to allows you to order prescriptions online without a doctor if it's just something basic like a cold. And it's easy to assume that this is innocuous. Why would they do anything with this information?
Yes, yes. And, you know, in terms of a clinic, maybe that's going to be covered by HIPAA, you know, so there's going to be more robust protections. HIPAA and its update in 2009, high tech, are a much, much better privacy law than anything else we have in the U.S. relating to data. But still, there is documentation of people's pharmacy records being used against them. And here's what happened. Back in 2008, it was exposed that insurers, when people were applying for insurance on the individual market, their insurer would force them to sign away the access to their medical records or to their pharmacy records. And then the insurer would look whether they had taken like an antidepressant. And for many insurers, large insurers, merely having taken an antidepressant was a red flag that led to no insurance being offered to that person.
Wow. So there are the real ramifications just to this information being shared. This is a great question from a caller, but we're almost out of time, but I want to ask it. Frank, have you interviewed people who work for these companies, and have you asked them what they do to protect their privacy?
You know, the best book written recently on that level is Julia Angwin's Dragnet Nation. She does a fantastic job of describing. It's kind of like a stunt, you know. But I mean, that's not generous enough to her. I mean, it's more than a stunt book. It's like sort of her effort to spend a few months being untraceable, and she goes to enormous lengths of getting these things called burner phones, and you know, being really ultra careful of using the Tor proxies, and you know, having these internet. Her internet use gets routed through all of these mirrors and things meant to obscure it, so it ends up being very slow often. So I'd highly recommend reading her book. In terms of interviewing people at the companies, you know, the irony is that I think a lot of the folks at these companies, they're oftentimes the folks at the top of society, and you know, they have enough money to sort of you know, end up not really worried that much if you know they data is used against them. I don't know, but I think also that a lot of the people at these companies have to sign non-disclosure agreements, so they can't talk even if they'd like to. They realize that, you know, they can't talk. And just to give one really good example of how invasive tracking is used by companies against their own employees, Uber China actually told their drivers that they would monitor them via GPS if they went to a protest, and if they went to the protest, they would be deactivated. Right?
Wow.
So if workers know that this type of thing is being deployed by Uber, you know, they have a sense that, like, if they're working at these companies and they're meeting someone like me or a journalist or something, that may well be tracked.
Mm. Yeah. Julia, final thoughts. Do you have any tips? What do you do to protect your privacy?
I try to follow my own advice and try to figure out who it is that is in the best position to represent me and my interests. But like Frank, I never feel as though the user is ultimately responsible for the way that privacy is viewed and regulated in the United States. It's never, to me, the user's fault.
And we have a comment from Jason on Facebook. We always thought this sort of monitoring would arrive as Big Brother, but in reality, it's lots of little brothers trading our information on the cheap.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Julia Horowitz, Consumer Protection Counsel for EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and Frank Pasquale is author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Thank you both for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It was great.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation with veteran journalist Sandy Tolan about his new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. He tells the story of Ramzi Aberdwan and his journey from stone thrower during the First Intifada to music student to music teacher, transforming the lives of thousands of Palestinian children living under occupation in the West Bank. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.